Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassam. Very nice to be here in Berkeley. I grew up in this, I was in university in the 60s, so Berkeley was kind of a mythic place. So I don't know what I expected, people with two heads or something different. But when I was a young traveler, before I became a bhikkhu, I remember going to staying in Morocco. Somehow I thought, well, Morocco must be really special, third world. And it was a very good insight. The insight was, well, people are people. Some were kind, some were rip-offs. Some were happy, some were unhappy. But really, people were people. That's a really helpful insight for me. I don't know what my mind had, can't remember, it was so long ago, but my mind had created these divisions. Third world, first world, whatever. So the word Berkeley for me is actually quite a iconic word. But then here we are, people are people. So I'm glad to see you all look kind of normal. I don't know what I expected, halos or I don't know. Anyway, it's nice to be here. The teachings of the Buddha are rather marvelous because over these 2.5 millennia, folk like us have been picking up teaching and using it to free the heart from suffering. So just that contemplation of the Buddha's skill and perception and his ability to use language and indicate to us how to cultivate a path which liberates us from suffering is just marvelous in itself. It's relevant and pertinent and very useful these many, many years later and continues to be. And then to be in a place like this, which is really beautiful, stained glass windows and all the art and imagery, reminding us of this possibility we have of enlightenment. And the icons, iconography changes, doesn't it, from culture to culture? So some of the icons I don't understand, but just that sense that there's symbology, there's architecture, there are forms, there are paintings, there are sculptures which remind us of the awakened mind, that art can be used that way, that beauty can be used that way to remind us not just to have to purchase the beauty and consume it and own it, but it points to something inside ourselves. This is the way to use art, which is reflective and symbolic rather than pointing to, like for me, if I look at a Buddha image, if someone looks at a Buddha image and then they want to buy it, or like if you look at a Buddha image, say, and you're attached to a kind of aesthetic of a Buddha image, and then the Buddha image, if it has a big nose, you don't like it. You like a, you know, you like a Buddha. You like your Buddha with a kind of normal nose. Or if the Buddha's posture isn't quite right or whatever. And that's a kind of aesthetic looking at a Buddha image, which is okay, and we all have that kind of aesthetic preferences. But it's not really what the symbology is about. The icon is pointing to you. So the idea of looking at a Buddha image is to reflect that which knows the Buddha, that's the awakened mind. So if I'm looking at a Buddha image and I look at, you know, it's glass, and that's a nice glass image. I wonder how I can get one from my monastery. Then that's great, isn't it? I want to own it. But if I look at the Buddha image and I see it, and then I can see greed arising, oh, I'd like two of those. Maybe I could go down the shop and get one before I go back to Canada. And I notice that my mind is greedy, that my mind wants to own this now, then I'm using the Buddha image as a way of awakening. I notice the mind, what the mind is doing, the awakened mind. And that's how art or beauty can be used in a way to point back to you. And you see, we were walking along the marina here, and then just a lovely... I live in a landlocked place, not a landlocked place, but I live inland, so to see the ocean is quite a treat for me. It's special. Winds blowing through, and the skyline of San Francisco across that bay, and they're peaceful, very beautiful. And then my mind says, ooh, I want to live here. You know, why didn't I start the monastery here? And that's what beauty can do. Beauty can just create a sense of wanting to own it and keep it and perpetuate it. That's not using beauty as a reflection. That's idolatry. I idolize beauty. So I see the beauty, I want to own it, I want to keep it. That's a kind of idolatry. But when something stops my mind, which is beautiful, a cloud, a pine tree, the face of a kind person, and my mind is just arrested by that beauty, it just stops because it is so beautiful. And I don't claim ownership of it. I just notice the silence of the mind. I just notice the mind doesn't have to be busy and distracted and so on, and I notice that. Then beauty is symbolic because it's pointing back to me. It's a symbol. So then it doesn't really matter what the Buddha looks like, really. Whether it's got the kind of aesthetic you like or not, it doesn't really matter, because by looking at the Buddha image, you awaken to what you're feeling right now. You know the feeling right now. And then that's that kind of awakened state, which we're always encouraging. We talk a lot about suffering and the end of suffering, but you don't have to suffer to practice. Not necessary, but suffering has a particularly particular quality to it, that if I don't figure it out, it's just going to keep coming back, isn't it? So if I have a shoe in my... if I have a stone in my shoe and I don't look at the stone, then I'll just be distracted by it, but I won't really figure out what's the problem. And then the stone in the shoe is saying, stop, 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 stop. What's going on? There's something down in your foot and you got to look at. And then finally I stop walking and I take my shoe off, I see the stone, I throw it out. So the stone kind of awakens me. But if I don't listen to that and I just... I'm going to get a blister, and I don't really take the opportunity. And it's the same with human conflict. The conflicts we have with ourselves, with others, with our own ideals and whatever, the sense of lack we feel, the disappointments and all of that, they are the kind of... they're the Devadutas, aren't they? They're the kind of heavenly messengers, which are saying there's something you need to learn here. There's something you need to really look at. And making conscious things like that, like the sense of lack or the sense of disappointment, is quite hard to do, because when we don't feel fulfilled, or when we feel there's something imperfect, we quite often project outwards with blame. Or we seek a compensation to try to fulfill that gap. We look outwards and we don't pause and allow that feeling of inadequacy or lack or suffering or disappointment. We don't allow it to become conscious. And if we don't allow it to become conscious, then we are driven by it. And we seek external things to stimulate us and such like, but we've not really gotten the stone out of the shoe. So that kind of the applying the awakened mind, making fully conscious a sense of, say, like something like disappointment. You feel a person's been has disappointed you in some way, and on a social level, you might have to address that. So it's a person who is working with you, or a partner, or someone, and on a social sense, you maybe have to say, yeah, you know, that's not appropriate. But on the kind of existential sense, on the sense of what the heart feels, the feeling of disappointment is very natural kind of feeling. And if we have the ability to be fully conscious of something like, for example, the feeling of disappointment. We just stay with that and don't seek a distraction or compensation. As the disappointment ends, we see it cease, we realize it arises and ceases in awareness, and that awareness is something which is profoundly peaceful if we allow ourselves to be that awareness. Because when disappointment arises, then of course desire arises too. The desire to not be disappointed. And then that desire seeks another object or seeks to blame. And we go away from our own heart. We go out into the external world to kind of rectify the disappointment. We need to do that on a social level, on a functional level, so disappointment can be useful, but on the existential level, that sense of something not being right or not fulfilling is so fundamental to understanding the Dhamma. Because in the very feeling of disappointment, we have an option. We have an option to be the knowing of disappointment, to see it arise and cease, or with the option to find something that isn't disappointing. And we all know this, we've been at this long enough, to find something which isn't disappointing. You can do it for short and brief periods of time, but inevitably the feeling of disappointment might arise. Whether it's a teacher, your own body, your own kids, your own partner, Theravada Buddhism, Mahayana Buddhism, they're all at times disappointing. And that's natural. It's natural. There's nothing wrong with that. Partner, teacher, whatever. I think of my own teachers. I've had such good fortune with really fine teachers. And they've been at times disappointing. But the disappointment wasn't them. It's just my own mind throwing something out. Now if I believed in that disappointment, I would have tried to blame them or run away or whatever. But if I could just stay with disappointment, what's this really like? What's this feeling like? And stay with that. And that's hard to do because it's not pleasant. It's not gratifying. It's not the same as having something which is really fulfilling in an emotional sense. But if I could just stay with that and just be allow disappointment to become fully conscious. And we can do that. We can do that. And if I allowed that to be, then the mind seeking something else, some other object now that isn't disappointing, that mind would not be engaged. And what was engaged is the capacity to be awake to change. And by witnessing the change, the disappointment ceases, and then there's a peace. Then there's a fulfillment which is not dependent on the object, which is not dependent on a person, not dependent on the experience. And this is what the transcendent teachings are about, the teachings on the unconditioned, the island, the peace, nibbana, the unformed, the unborn. These different ways we talk about that transcendent possibility of peace in the human heart. And it comes about through a kind of deep, deep sense of, I think it's a kind of renunciant sense. Renunciation is one of the paramitas, nikkamma. And renunciation is usually portrayed through monastic robes. So we are renunciants in that sense. But renunciation has a kind of deeper implication, and renunciation really points to an insight that we can have that anything that begins ends, and to seek that which is not dependent in that which is dependent is a false kind of seeking. If I have a sense of what spiritual life is about, not just psychological life. Psychological life is as it is, and we try to get that right. Social life, we try to get that right. But what the Buddha was really, where he was coming from, was his own enlightenment. Yes, that's why he taught. He didn't teach because he had some kind of utopian idea about society, and he wasn't teaching as a psychotherapist. And he was teaching as an enlightened being. And from his own enlightenment, then he tried to lay out for us a way where we could realize that too. That's his great compassion. We could come to this possibility because it's a human possibility. And what he was constantly emphasizing, and what Buddhism has been emphasizing, all spiritual practices I think should be, that the whole sense of peaceful possibility in the human heart is not the usual kind of experience we get through time, by finding something out there in some future time. We were talking at tea time, one of the gentlemen mentioned the idea of transcendence, and transcendence is always conjoined in most language on these issues with immanence, that which is here and now. In the Pali chanting we chant, this is not a matter of time, the Dhamma is not a matter of time, imminent, here and now, imminent, here and now. And if you look at an experience like disappointment, then seeking of non-disappointment is in time. I don't want this experience, I want another kind of experience. And I begin to search. And that search in time is searching in the wrong way. It doesn't work. Because anything you find in time will be born and will die. But the Buddha teaches us, he brings us this language. There is the unconditioned, the unoriginated, the unborn, the deathless, peace, the island, Nibbana, the refuge. As you can, you know, because I'm in the business, I love using that language. It's very, very appealing to me. And if you really contemplate that kind of language, it's not language that you can pin down with an object. You can't really pin it down. But you can see that all objects are born and die, all sense experiences are born and die. They're not unconditioned, they're not deathless. They're born in time. So the true renunciant is not simply someone who parks themselves in a monastery and shaves their head. It's rather the deep sense that whatever the Buddha realized can't be tomorrow. Whatever the Buddha realized can't be an experience, because all experience comes and goes. It has to be something rather different, rather different. And so the suggestion the Buddha makes to us then is, can you sustain presence of mind, and rather than get caught up and attached and preferential with all these experiences, can you see them as things which arise and cease? Can you see them as change? And this is called lakkhana, this is called characteristic. The characteristic of conditioned phenomena is they're conditioned, they begin and they end. Now to hold the mind in that kind of reference of this is something that's changing is not so easy. So if I feel disappointed by someone, if I feel, let's say even worse, let's say if I feel betrayed by someone, let's say I'm really loyal to someone and I really support them in their difficulties, and then I find out through another channel that they stabbed me in the back, they betrayed me. That's very painful. That's a very, very painful feeling. And so I feel that painful feeling, and of course I don't want to be with that painful feeling. And so I seek some way of revenge or distraction or whatever. And I get born into the world of experience. So the experience of betrayal then becomes the experience of resentment, becomes the experience of blame, becomes the experience of anger. And my whole consciousness now is preoccupied with birth and death, with becoming, with objects, with thoughts, with emotions. And my consciousness is no longer available to the unconditioned. Because why? Because I'm totally absorbed by the conditioned, the emotions, the body, and all of that. My mind now is just taken by, reborn into, consumed by, kidnapped by conditioned phenomena. So the Buddha tries to help us by saying, well, can you look at this phenomena as phenomena rather than a storyline? So we're recommended to look at body as body, feeling as feeling, thought as thought, emotion as emotion, to begin to see them as objects which come and go. Sure, there's a narrative. Sure, there's a subject line. I have to call the person all their betrayal. I need to do all that, and I do it the best I can. But that's not transcendent. That's worldly. It's necessary. It's good. But the transcendent, then, is trying to get a different kind of perspective on our life, on our emotional life. And so the capacity to know a mood of the mind as a mood of the mind, the capacity to know disappointment as disappointment, or let's say betrayal as betrayal. What is betrayal like? And betrayal, when I notice it as a condition, then it's pointing back to awareness. And it's the same as the Buddha Rupa. The Buddha Rupa is an object, a visual object, which stimulates my senses in some way, but it's always pointing to this awareness, awareness. So is something more difficult, such as betrayal. Betrayal always points, disappointment always points, inspiration always, all of these different conditions point to something which is not conditioned, it's the awareness of change. The worldly life, the life where renunciation isn't truly understood, is always one which just goes out into the objects of sense. And we need to do that. We need to go to work and make sure the kids get fed and the car has gas in it. Right, that there's nothing wrong with that. But is there more? You know, is there a dimension which is deeper than that? And there is. And I think we've all tasted in some ways, somehow, little bits of it. And the Buddha certainly offers us something to realize that. Now when we take something difficult like betrayal or disappointment and we have the renunciant insight that which has a nature to arise has a nature to cease, and that being distracted by that, being preoccupied by that, precludes the possibility of being available to the unconditioned. Availability is very important. If I'm not available, my consciousness is preoccupied, I'm not available to something fresh and new or whatever, then how can I realize this? I can't, because my mind has no space. So we're encouraged to let go of thought, to let go of proliferation. And that's hard, isn't it? That's a really hard thing to do, not to just be blah, blah, blah in the head all the time. It's very, very hard. So we're encouraged to do things to somehow bring that sense of availability. And how do we do that? We're watchful. So these two, watchful, available. Watchful, available. Watchful, available. We're training in. We're training in that constantly. In all the things that we do. Now when I come across something like disappointment, or I don't know why I'm talking about that. I haven't felt terribly disappointed or betrayed, but anyway, something comes onto the mind. I have to talk about something. But anyway, whatever it is, whether it's fear or greed or whatever, it kind of really grabs my attention. I get caught up into it. And that's the practice of not doing that, not going there. It's not the practice of denying these things, but it's the practice of stepping into a perception which frees the mind. And that perception is that if it began, it will end. And that we call lakkhana samadhi. We call that the samadhi or the attentiveness of the characteristic of these things. And if it began, it will end. But our search is not for something that began and end. Our search or our realization is that which does not begin, does not end. The unconditioned, the deathless. This is the goal. Peace, nirvana. Let's say I get betrayed by someone. And I have enough mindfulness now to know this is an object now. So the betrayal points back to the sense of awareness. My desire mind doesn't want this. My desire mind wants to blame. But no, I'll stick this one out because I've been through this before. And I'll watch and I'll observe. I'll see it as change. Now that, bringing up that perception, anicca sanya, bringing up that perception is quite hard. Because usually the perception I have is I'm going to kill this person, or I'm going to at least take their air out of their tires, or at least going to gossip about them, send them a rotten email or something. I'm going to do something about this. I am the one that was hurt. So rather than the perception of change, the perception of me and them comes into consciousness. And I don't see this emotional state as an object. I become the subject. And as I become the subject, I get preoccupied with it. I get preoccupied with it. And then maybe I do some serious hatefulness for a while, and then I'm a good Buddhist, and then I feel guilty. So having hated them for 2 hours, and finally something clicks in, this doesn't sound like Buddhism to me. So then I hate myself. I'll do that. That sounds more like Buddhism, but it's not. It's just hating yourself. And the mind just struggles and fights and struggles and fights because it's caught in the storylines of self, in the storylines of me and mine and narratives of self. But at some point, I say, oh, this is just an object. This is an emotion. This has bodily content. It creates tension. I step back and I let go of I-making, my-making. We have these two words in the Pali, ahankara, mimankara, really neat words, ahankara mimankara, I making, mind making, the manufacture of a sense of I through thought. But you don't have to do that. Hard not to do it, but you don't have to do that. You can notice something like betrayal as a tension in the body, as a sense of memory, as very painful. And the more I do that, the more I come to the gateway of the deathless, of the unconditioned. And anyone who's wrote out something difficult like that and allowed it to just be the way it is, just be the way it is, and sit it out and say, I'm going to watch this thing change, and has had the persistence, patience, and insight to watch it change. And as it changes, the heart has this different kind of peace now, because it's the peace where the craving or the desire to have something else, that has been dissipated. And Nibbana sometimes is synonymous with the cessation of craving, the cessation of wanting. So that peace, you watch something and you watch the wanting to get rid of, wanting to blame, and you're really on your game, you're really aware, you're really present. And you see it cease. And you say, wow, look at that. I didn't get rid of it, and my mind's really, really peaceful now. And that gives you a kind of strong sense of confidence in renunciation. Not renunciation isn't getting rid of, it's just seeing that the transcendent is always imminent, and the imminent is always transcendent, and that's not by going anywhere, it's by being with that which changes. It's a change, it's a whole different way of operating. So we live our Buddhist lives in sort of two, there's still kind of two streams of teaching. One is the social teaching, and the social teaching is to be responsible, to be moral, to make sure you brush your teeth and floss, all those important things in our social life, to honor your parents and to take care of your body and to take care of the water and have good education systems. And we try to do that the best we can. And that's where we employ the sense of I in Buddhist language. I am Viradhammo. I live in the Ottawa area. I have a Canadian passport. I'm 68 years old, and so on and so forth. And that's where we use the sense of I. This is the conventional truth. And that's important. We don't dismiss that. In our bhikkhu lives, we talk about the Vinaya. We have our discipline. We have the way we live. And within that, we're also trying to look at our experience as phenomena, mental phenomena, physical phenomena. Both of these are important. So if as a bhikkhu, then I have a certain set of principles which I live by, and that governs my social life. So as lay people, you have certain principles. You have the precepts, you have your own families, your own vocations and different responsibilities. That defines the kind of vehicle you're driving in. So you have a different vehicle than I. But in terms of mind and emotions, we're the same. We experience life the same. We love and we hate, and we're disappointed and we're inspired. We do the same. So our aspiration then is not a social aspiration. The method is to get the social bit right, to live by precepts, to live a life of generosity. That's the method, but not the goal. The goal isn't utopian perfection. The goal isn't to have a perfect relationship. The goal isn't to have a perfect monastery. The goal isn't to have everyone in harmony, because it's impossible. It's impossible. But the goal is also not to be destructive and hurtful and divisive and egotistical. That's not the goal either. But the method is, how can I live in harmony? How can I do as little harm as possible? How can I honor my parents? How can I make sure that the monks are getting enough instruction, or whatever my duties are. It's the method. So compassion is the method. Generosity is the method. Morality is the method. And that lays a foundation of presence. That lays a foundation which is not caught up with remorse. And then the renunciation is seeing that it's not about a social perfection. It's not about a physical perfection. It's seeing that on that level there is no perfection. It's always subject to change, always fraught, always nebulous. And so you look for the rather than looking for an object to perfect you, you begin to see that, wow, there's awareness there. What's that awareness about? and you begin to develop that samadhi or that attentiveness which is aware of change, and then you begin to see, oh, that's what it's about. That's where peace lies. Not in changing the objects of sense, but in knowing that the object of sense is changing. It's just a bit of a shift. It's the same as looking at a Buddha Rupa and thinking, oh, I want two of those. And then the Buddha Rupa points back to me, oh, there's awareness. So all things point to awareness. All things point to presence. And the idea is not to get the perfect object, but it's to see that that which knows is perfection already. And then you find your real home. Then you remember, oh yeah, that's what it's about. We forget. And much of the practice is just talks like this, same old stuff. Buddhism 101. There's no Buddhism 102, by the way. It's just same old, same old. And yet somehow it's important, isn't it? And we forget. And with Ajahn Chah, I just get all kind of lost, and he just bring me back to the presence again and again. You think you're with a great teacher, and somehow he has a magic wand. Oh, you were with Ajahn Chah, and what did he do? He put his hands on your head and you became enlightened. If only. Yeah. But it's not that way. It's just this, you just meet someone who's really present and beautiful, and you think, oh yeah, I'd like to be like that. And how do you do that? He says, oh, just let go. What do you mean, let go? Just let go. And then you go back to your kuti. What does he mean by letting go? Okay, I'll let go. It's not working. I'm not letting go. He says, well, listen, you go back. Well, how do you do this? Don't make it a problem. And you go back to your kuti. Don't make it a problem. I must not make this a problem. Yes. And slowly realize, oh, it's just about change. Yeah. And then you look at the Buddha Rupa, and there's the greed for the Buddha Rupa. That's not a problem, it's just greed. And I'm broke anyway. Can't buy one. But you say, oh, greed is just greed. It feels that way. And anger is just anger. It's just that. So you live morally in a way where you don't act on those things, but you don't make it a problem. And then greed comes and goes, and fear comes and goes. But all the kind of egotistical things begin to die away, and the mind begins to have a kind of freedom from conditions, because now, because the method is compassion, the method is goodness, the method is generosity, the conditions that come up now are quite buoyant. You think about the memories of generosity. They're lovely, but the memories of hatefulness are not lovely. Right? So again, the mind just begins to have a kind of lightness, because the methodology is about lightness. It's about non-ego. And the mind has a kind of natural buoyancy because it's not caught up with memory. Like monastic life, I can't remember hardly any of it. Because what can you remember? It's the same chanting every morning. You can remember the chant. Or the same chanting every evening. The same blokes that I sit around with, right? There's no real memory, nothing exciting. That sounds awful, I know. And yet, if you're practicing mindfulness and you're not looking for an experience, then it's perfect. So my early years in Thailand were excruciating and boring, really, because there was nothing going on. But the problem was that I'd always just stimulated the mind with excitement and interest and so on, it wasn't immoral, but I just hadn't learned how to just be at home with the way things are. So the karmic result was boredom and restlessness. But as the teacher says, just watch boredom, restlessness. What do you mean, watch it? I've been watching it for 2 days. No, try a few years. Oh, okay. And yeah, just watch it. And then slowly that boredom and restlessness dies away. But it dies away not through my distracting it, but by knowing it. So what is strengthened? The strengthened is the awareness. The awareness gets strong and the need for objects falls away. And there's a naturalness to that. So much of the practice is just being patient, hanging in there, noticing difficult states of mind, saying, oh, this too will change, again and again and again. And that has its results. It has very, very good results. You just have to have faith. You need faith in this. It's not belief, it's like trust and faith in the awareness of change. So I've talked a lot today. We had a good tea session, so I'd just like to maybe stop there and offer that for your reflection. But in closing, I just would like to wish you a very fruitful practice in Dhamma, obviously good health and prosperity and all those good things, but also may this beautiful teaching be both edifying and liberating for you in your path. So I wish you the realization of Nibbana. Okay? Thank you.
Annamayam no vargataya saru karang vidamase sadhu 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 anumodam.
Do you have questions? Usually? No, anyone would like to add to that? Question, query, comment? We've got a few minutes, I think. Yes.
Thank you so much for being with us this evening.
Pleasure.
I wanted to express my appreciation for your talk at the cantina as well.
Uh-huh.
There were many of us who were unaware of the honors that we bestowed on Ajahn Pasta.
Good to know, isn't it? Yeah. Maybe I just share that with everyone?
Yeah.
In Thai culture, there's an honor which is bestowed on monks who have been very instrumental in spreading the Dhamma and been very diligent in their own practice. And it's a kind of, I guess it's sort of a lifetime achievement award. It's kind of looking through my mind what Western culture has. So like the Oscars, I think you get a lifetime, some people get a lifetime achievement award, or in literature and the arts, there are those in community service. So Thailand has a system. Thailand has maybe, at any given time, 200,000 monks. Almost 250,000 monks. That's a lot of monks. So there's sort of two streams. There's a stream of administrators, and they get given titles. But also, these titles are given to monks who have been prominent in their own practice and in the sharing of Dhamma. And the title is called Chao Kun, which is hard to translate. It's the equivalent of an OBE or something like that in the British system, or the Order of Canada. Those are my associations. And the title then is bestowed by the king, and the king of Thailand is very sick now, so some representative of his. But it comes from the peers, the Sangha itself. So the senior members of the order suggest a name of a monk or other monks to receive this award. So this on December 5th in the Royal Palace in Bangkok, Ajahn Lompa Pasano and Ajahn Amaro will both receive this award, which is the first time two Westerners have received this. And I think only this will only be the third and fourth Westerners who have actually received this award. So it's very, very significant in Thai culture for someone to be given that. And the title itself, Chao Kun, is also comes with a name. You get the Chao Kun has a kind of new name. And Lompa Pasano's Chao Kun name is Bodhinyan Witet. Bodhinyan, Bodhi is from Bodhi, enlightenment. Jnana is like knowledge, enlightened knowledge. And that was the name that was given to Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Chah received this same title so many years ago, can't remember. So that Lompa Pasana, when he heard that Bodhinyana was in his name, was very touched, very moved by that. And Vitate means a foreign country, so it's outside of Thailand. So it's Bodhinyana outside of Thailand. A very, very, very beautiful, very beautiful thing. Now in Buddhist culture here, we were talking about chaplaincy. We're talking about chaplaincy and how trying to get credentials for chaplaincy. So Buddhism isn't yet old enough in this culture to have these kinds of awards and situations, but Thailand has that. So it's all, and also it's a real compliment to the monasteries that have started connected to Thailand. It's a very compliment to the lay people, because Ajahn Pasano does not live in some kind of a vacuum. He is totally dependent on the lay people around him. So it's a real It's a real honor to what we're doing as Buddhists outside of Thailand. It's really honoring our work in a really beautiful way. It's not a rank. It's not like it's General Amaro now. Or Colonel Pustano or something like that. So it's not rank. And, you know, you'd think, well, Buddhism's about not self, right? It's not about not self. But there is conventional truth. As I was saying, there are these conventional identities, and we use them, and then we let go of them, right? But I think it is important that in culture, that which is beautiful is honored. You know, that which is diligent, that which is wise is honored. So we have a sense, yeah, there is that. And it won't go to Lompa Pasano's head. That won't be a problem. We know that. But it's a huge, huge thing. So on the 5th, they'll have that ceremony in the palace, and then I think right after that they'll go to Ajahn Chandi's, which is near Bangkok, and there'll be a big ceremony for him and both of them in Ajahn Amaro, and then they'll go up to the Isan, and like in the Isan, like the monk from a certain village, it's this is our boy, he's made it big, you know, there's that kind of feeling. So they'll go back to the to Wat Nanachat, and there'll be a big ceremony there, honoring them there. And then I'm sure they'll do something at Abayagiri too. And we don't have the history. We don't know quite what to do. Hi Chaukun, you know, what do you say now? The Thais have all this etiquette and beautiful formality, but I'm sure you'll think of something, right? Hint, hint. So it's, thank you for bringing that up. Great honor. Any questions?
In reincarnation, is it the awareness that gets reincarnated?
It's desire that gets reborn. And the way out is through awareness. How it works, I don't know. I don't know the mechanism. But if you look at it logically, okay, let's go back to the example of betrayal. You get blindsided by someone who you've been really good to, right? You get blindsided, and then you're not mindful, and you think, I'm going to get that guy. You know, I'm going to make sure that he loses his job. And you make a serious commitment to hurting him. Right? That's rebirth. And that comes from desire. And you know, let's say a person's really heedless and they spend the next 10 years trying to destroy this guy. They got reborn because they attached to the desire for revenge. Now how that works when the body dies, no idea. No idea. But you could see, if consciousness is not just a physical phenomenon, which I don't think it is, right? And in the body dies, and there is this kind of unrectified desire to get something or destroy, then we would say that's the energy which creates the next rebirth, next incarnation. That's about as much as I don't go any further than that, because I know I'll just spin my mind around. Well, how does it work? I don't know. But I can see that operating right now. I can see that in either positive or negatives. But if I have the aspiration, say, to go beyond this kind of birthing process, and I watch that, then what watches that is the awareness. That's what we say, the awareness is the gateway to the unconditioned. It's the avenue through. What that is, if you try to nail it down as a condition, even if you say peace, then you get caught in the duality, oh, this isn't peace, so we try to get something called peace. So the language is left very nebulous just for that reason. It's left like you can't formulate it. Because as soon as you formulate it, you try to get it and you're caught. So we just said, be aware of change. Be aware of change. Make sense? Kind of? It's deep stuff. It doesn't, you know, it's not like 2 and 2 equals 4. But you have a good contemplative mind, so keep that, you know, keep that going. It's really valuable. Any others? Or should we cash in our chips? Or any questions? I think, yeah, we've got a big journey tomorrow, so perhaps we could leave it there. Do we usually close with a closing homage?
What do we usually close with?
Whatever you want.
Whatever you want.
There's a closing...
closing announcement.
Well, there's the dedication. We could do
that. Imina, or in English?
Sharing the merit.
Sharing the merit.
Yeah. Sounds good. Find that on page something. 26, 27. Now let us chant the verses of sharing and aspiration. Through the goodness that arises from my practice, may my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent, or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless. Through the goodness that arises from my practice and through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease, and all harmful states of mind, until I realize Nibbana in every kind of birth. May I have an upright mind with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge. Unsurpassed is the protection of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my noble lord. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled.